So good morning, everyone. So let's start today with just doing a few prayers, and then I'm going to do a short, very short meditation just to set our motivation for today. And then, as I mentioned, we'll do a meditation on equanimity. Maybe I'll just say a few words about equanimity to recap last night before we do that meditation. So for today, let's start with doing the four immeasurable thoughts that are on the handout that you have. Did everyone get this when you came in? And most of you were here last night, but if not, there's a single sheet, and then there's the notes that I'm going to be referring to throughout the teachings this weekend. So what we're going to do is recite the four immeasurable thoughts that are on that page. We'll pause after each of these and just bring to mind whatever your own understanding of these are. We've talked about equanimity, but we'll go on to love, compassion, joy over the next few sessions. But we all have an understanding of what some of these ideas are, so we can just spend a minute or so after each of them and generate that thought. And even if you wish to kind of feel the blessings of the holy beings, the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, our gurus, kind of descending down into you, helping you to actualize that. So let's begin with immeasurable equanimity. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. May they abide in equanimity. I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. And then let's recite the verse for immeasurable love. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness and the causes of happiness. May they have happiness and its causes. I myself will cause them to have happiness and its causes. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. And then we cultivate immeasurable compassion. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May they be free of suffering and its causes. I myself will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. And then finally, immeasurable joy. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were never separated from the happiness of higher rebirth and liberation. May they never be separated from these. I myself will cause them to never be separated from these. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. Let's go to page 98 of the prayer book, and we'll do the refuge in bodhicitta verse. We'll do this once in English and then twice in the Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chodang soki choknam la chang chu bardu dakni kyab su chi daki chunyen gi pe sonam gi drola penshir sangye drupar shok Sangye chodang soki choknam la chang chu bardu dakni kyab su chi daki chunyen gi pe sonam gi drola penshir sangye drupar shok. And let's just do a short meditation to set our motivation. And then, as I said, I'll talk a little bit more about equanimity. And then we'll do a meditation on that immeasurable thought. But just find a comfortable meditation posture. Make sure that the back is straight, that you have a nice uprightness to the body. And at the same time, be sure to relax the body into this posture as much as you can, letting go of any tension that you feel, particularly in the neck and shoulder area. Sometimes we feel some tension in the heart center, sometimes even a bit of tension in the lower abdomen and lower back. Just wherever you find that there's some tension, try to soften into those areas. We're going to start with just a few minutes of meditating on the breath. As I mentioned last night, if you have a technique that you use, you can do that for the next few minutes. If not, then you can tune into the sensation that occurs towards the tip of the nose as you breathe in and out through the nostrils. And with any breathing meditation, the idea is that we stay focused on the breath in whatever way that we're using the breath. And whenever we get distracted, we gently let go of those distractions and bring the mind back to the breath. So I'll ring the bell, and we'll do this in silence for just a few minutes, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection to set motivation for today. So now, with our minds a bit more focused, let's generate a motivation of bodhicitta for today. As I mentioned last night, our whole spiritual path can be encompassed in two main ideas. One, to remove the negative tendencies that we have, the negative thoughts that cause ourselves suffering, but also cause suffering to others. And then to increase those thoughts that are positive and wholesome, that produce the opposite result, that result in happiness for ourselves as well as for others. So we're here this weekend to examine these qualities that are a part of developing the kind heart, these positive qualities that by their very nature are an antidote to the negative tendencies that we have, the selfishness, self-centeredness, the anger, the attachment, the greed, the jealousy, the ignorance, all of these that plague our minds, and replacing those negative states with more positive attitudes. These four attitudes of equanimity, love, compassion, and joy. So we're doing important work this weekend in terms of following the Buddha's instructions on how to achieve true, lasting happiness. And it starts with ourselves and that wish for happiness and freedom from suffering for ourselves. This is where our path begins, is recognizing our own desire, that fundamental desire that each of us has to not suffer, to be happy. And think that you're here this weekend, particularly today in this session, with that thought that you want to accomplish some understanding and integration of these positive minds so that you can become happy yourself. You can be free of suffering yourself. There's nothing wrong with starting there. But then to expand this thought, to think that others in the room, others in this world, other sentient beings, wherever they exist, are all fundamentally just like you, seeking happiness as well, wanting to avoid pain, dissatisfaction, suffering, just like you. So it would be very limited if we said we were here only for ourselves. We can start with ourselves, but we need to enlarge that idea. Think that we're also here to have the greatest positive effect on others, beginning with a temporal effect through understanding how these states of mind we're cultivating this weekend will help us to be kinder towards others, help us to be more concerned about their welfare. But they also create the positive qualities from which our enlightenment will develop. And so hold that thought as well, that you're here not just for the temporal benefit for others, but for that more ultimate benefit, to be able to become fully enlightened yourself, so you can then lead all sentient beings to that same state. And think that it's for this reason that you're here, to engage in these teachings. So as I mentioned, I just want to say a few things on equanimity before we do a meditation, following the instructions that are in your handout. As I explained last night, equanimity, we could give it a couple of other words, like an even-mindedness or an equal regard. And the idea behind this mind is that this is the foundation for the other thoughts that we're going to be working with in this session as well as through this afternoon and tomorrow. If we don't have sort of a level playing field, which we saw last night that we have a bias towards these three groups of people in terms of how we relate to them, how our attitudes are formed around them. So it's natural for us to divide sentient beings into three groups. This is just part of our experience, that we're going to have those that are much closer to us, that are our friends. I use the analogy of us being on a stage. Each of us have our own stage, our own theater that we're in. And the front row, all the people who we can see there, all their smiling faces, those are the people who are our friends and dear ones, family members, people who support us, who really are there for us in ways that are unlike the other people in the theater. Then we have the darkness of the theater, the larger portion of the population that are strangers to us, that Again, because we haven't had that direct contact with them, it's very hard for us to even be cognizant of those beings, much less their situation. And so we're a bit blind to that reality, and we have an indifference towards them, whereas we have a strong attachment towards the friends, the people that are in our front row. And then we have this strong aversion towards the third group, the people who keep interrupting the show, who are throwing things at us, who are, you know, yelling at us, screaming at us, doing whatever. Those people who make life difficult for us. So we have three different groups that people naturally fall into. Beings are going to fall into one of those categories. Pema Chodron even talks about how the strangers are simply people who we haven't met yet to determine whether they're a friend or an enemy. You know, we don't know yet what they are. And so at some level, everyone is going to be in one of these categories. And there's a fluidity to all of this. It's not like they're set in that category. But at any point in time, we could say that there are beings who fall into those three groups. The distortion is our attitudes towards that. The distortion isn't that we're doing that. Obviously, it would be nice if we could open our hearts and feel a sort of kinship and friendship with all beings, but it's not realistic to think that we could actually do that in this life. We can try to expand our horizons in terms of becoming closer and closer to more and more people, but the reality is that sentient beings are going to naturally fall into these three categories. Even the Buddha himself had someone who fell into the category of an enemy. I mentioned, you know, how the Dalai Lama has enemies. Well, the Buddha himself, this fully enlightened being whose teachings we follow, had his cousin Devadatta, who hated him, who thought he was, you know, a horrible person, tried to kill him. You know, so it's understandable that this still is going to happen, that beings are going to fall into those categories. So the distortion is the attitude we have towards them. As we said in the prayer, the attachment that we have for friends and the hatred that we have for enemies. These two are the most operative in terms of causing pain for ourselves and blocking ourselves from really being genuinely concerned about others. Having a mind that is willing to, you know, open up to the welfare of other beings. But then, of course, the indifference, this third one that isn't mentioned in our prayer, but the indifference that we have towards the strangers is also problematic because it is limiting, it's restricting, not allowing ourselves to really achieve our full potential. So these distorted attitudes are what we're trying to equalize, what we're trying to get rid of, so that we can see all sentient beings, therefore, as worthy, as deserving of our love, our compassion, and so on, these qualities that we're going to be examining. So again, the meditation that we're going to be going through will have an opportunity to reflect on each of these three points that are about halfway down the page that give us an opportunity to have a foundation for equalizing our relationship with these beings or our attitude towards these beings, to developing that equal regard or equal concern. The first one, to understand the impermanence, that there is this flow going on, even within a single lifetime, even within a single day, beings that will at one moment appear like they're in the front row, all friendly towards us, and then suddenly they become an enemy, someone difficult. And if we look back on our lives, we know that we've had that experience, that ways that were more permanent, where people who you were quite close to, who did something that offended you and affected you negatively, and then they were out the door. You know, you didn't want anything more to do with them, right? So we know that there's nothing set about this in this lifetime. But if we go into the idea that we've had countless lifetimes, which is taught within the concept of mind having a continuity, that we have a continuity of rebirths that we've been involved in, so everybody that we've had a relationship with has varied from time to time. Sometimes they've been a stranger, sometimes they've been a friend, sometimes they've been an enemy, and even in individual lives, they floated back and forth between those. So there's nothing constant about this. It's all very transitory. And this should begin to loosen up these negative attitudes that we have towards others, the attachment for friends, the anger towards enemies, the indifference towards strangers. Another way we can loosen that up is understanding the differing perspectives, to understand that not everybody sees that person in the same way, that even somebody who's our worst enemy could be an object of great love and compassion for someone else. And so the ways that we're all the same is the third that we'll look at, and this is the understanding that just as we mentioned at the beginning in our meditation today, just as we have the desire to be happy and to not suffer, every being is equal in that same way. So there's no real foundation for us to have attachment for friends and be more concerned about their well-being versus the strangers, the enemies, and so on, because they're all the same in that fundamental way. They also all have the same basic qualities, both positive and negative, in their minds. You know, again, again, even the worst being that we can imagine, still has some level of love, compassion, positive qualities. They have a lot of negative qualities, perhaps, too, but we all have, you know, this combination of these in our minds. And also that the very nature of every one of our minds is the same, with the same potential. This is what I talked about last night, again, is Buddha nature, that we all have that fundamentally clear and pure mind that is sort of a receptacle in which all of the negative stuff is hanging out, and all that negative stuff can be removed because it's not in the nature of that mind. Just like the dirt in a glass of water is not in the nature of the water. It can be filtered out and removed, and the pure, clear water can be revealed. This is the nature of our minds at the deepest level, what we call our Buddha nature, that this is the same for every single being. So once more, should we have a bias towards beings on the basis of understanding that everyone is fundamentally the same in terms of their potential to develop their minds fully? So all three of these will be kind of examining the impermanence, the differing perspectives, the ways that we're all the same as part of this meditation. So I did want to talk, before we go into the meditation, a little bit about what are called the far enemies and the near enemies of equanimity. This is a concept that comes, I think it's from a text by Kamala Shila. I was unable to find the actual text, but it's actually mentioned, some teachings are in, can't think of his name at the moment, Thupten Jinpa's book, Fearless Heart. Have any of you read that book? Yeah, really wonderful book. There's a little section in there on the four immeasurables. And he talks about this, what we mean by a far enemy, and we'll go through this for each of the four immeasurables. A far enemy is, what's the exact opposite to this? What is it that's kind of like the main thing that we're trying to combat by developing that mind, or the main thing that gets in the way of having that mind? Near enemies are those things that are very close to what that mind is, so that we could confuse them with that mind. We could think that, oh, I've got equanimity, oh, I've got love, but you're off the mark slightly because you're not quite there in terms of having clearly defined it and developed it. So in terms of equanimity, we've already touched on the far enemies. There's a few of them. Attachment and hatred, the two that we identified, these are the far enemies of equanimity, because when we have those minds operative towards people, towards beings, they don't allow us to have a mind of equanimity. They are the main target of developing equanimity. And we could say that the indifference or the ignorance that is there towards the strangers is also a part of that. But nonetheless, indifference is sometimes called the near enemy, because sometimes we think when we get to a state of indifference that we're actually at equanimity, but we're not. The other thing that we could say is a far enemy, though, besides hatred and attachment, is what we would just simply call partiality or bias. Kind of having a mind that looks upon others with some level of prejudice, some level of kind of having an attitude towards them that is distorted. As I mentioned, all of these states of mind, whether we talk about attachment, hatred, or ignorance, these are all distortions of reality. We are not looking at things correctly. And of course, this is why they can be removed, is because they are not grounded in truth. Equanimity acts as an antidote to our sort of prejudices, our biases that we have, because it shows us how it really is. Particularly that third point, you know, the ways that we're all the same. When it comes down to it, this is the most fundamental level of conventional reality, that we're all really the same. And when we're looking at our theater of people, whether people are in the front row or in the very back in the dark, or whether they're people busting in and disturbing our show, the enemies, the difficult people, they're all fundamentally the same in that very basic way. So when we're able to understand that truth, then we're able to uproot all of these biases that are operative. So these are what are usually identified and what Thupten Jinpa identifies in his book as the three enemies, the far enemies of equanimity, the mind of attachment, hatred, and then any sort of prejudice or bias that we might have that is resulting from our not understanding things correctly. For the near enemy, as I mentioned, it's a sort of kind of blind indifference, or even what we might call an apathy. You know, the point of this meditation is not to arrive at a place where you don't care about anybody, where you kind of have this equal, just kind of blah feeling towards everybody in the room, everyone in your theater. You know? The idea is that you want to be able to feel an equal regard and concern for everyone in them. You want to see that they're all on the same level, that they're not all down below and sort of in some area where we're not even going to pay attention to them. Rather, we want to bring them all up to the same level of regard. You know. So once more, this doesn't mean that we have to redefine everyone as being a friend, because we currently have a pretty high regard for those people in our front row. Those are the ones that we do take care of. Those are the ones that we do have love and compassion for very easily. But rather what it means is that we are going to have the same level of regard just on the basis that we have an understanding that everybody in the theater is the same, that the roles that they're playing in this life are different than the roles they played in the last life or earlier in this life, that things are constantly changing and so on. So we're just trying to arrive at an equal regard for everybody, not a bland indifference, not a sort of apathy towards beings. Rather, we want to feel our heart open to every one of them. And that was even, you know, how we talked about equanimity at the top of the page, right? This definition or description from Kathleen MacDonald in her book. Equanimity is an unbiased, impartial attitude that regards all beings as equally deserving of our respect and concern, our love and compassion. So it's important that when we get into meditating on equanimity and get a flavor for it and a feeling for it, that we don't fall into that kind of indifference, that sort of blandness. So any questions on equanimity before we do the meditation? No? Okay. So if you want to stand up, just because we've been sitting for a little while, if you want to stand up and kind of move around a little before you sit back in meditation, that's fine. Any of these meditations, it's good to maybe wake up the body a little bit before we sit down, because it's one of those kinds of days. Better to like not meditate in bed or anything, you know, because that's what we'll probably do is fall asleep. So if you want to stretch for just a moment, that's fine, and then we'll do a short meditation.
Do a laughing meditation to wake us up.
Could I just ask you a question?
Sure, Anna.
Oh,
1 second. I'll get the... Aaron's got.
Oh, for the streaming.
Equanimity, so is that exchanging oneself for the other, Tonglen, or is that entirely something different? Thank you.
So Anna's question about whether equanimity is related to Tonglen or is the practice of Tonglen, we could say is the foundation for a practice of Tonglen. We're going to talk about Tonglen tomorrow afternoon because it's one of the most powerful ways to bring these two minds of love and compassion into, you know, a more tangible form in our own hearts. It might be better just to wait, and I'll explain more of that tomorrow afternoon when we go through bodhicitta and how the four immeasurables relate to bodhicitta, and the practice of Tonglen will be discussed there. Yeah, good. Okay, are we ready to meditate? Got our meditation shoes on? So... So as before, just find a comfortable posture. We're going to do just a few minutes of focused meditation on the breath. This is always good to start our meditations with that first. Give ourselves a chance to kind of let go of distractions in the mind, to be a bit more focused. And then I'll lead you in this meditation on equanimity. Again, we'll go through the steps. You don't need to have them in front of you or anything, because I'll just be guiding you in that.
walk.
So with each of these immeasurables, we're working with immeasurable sentient beings. So we're going to begin each of them in a similar way by trying to visualize all sentient beings surrounding us. You can do this with the theater analogy if that works for you. Again, we have those beings that we currently classify as friends or dear ones. These are the people and even animals that we feel very close to. Our pets, our friends, family members. You can either visualize them on either side and in the space behind you, or if you're using the theater analogy, you can think of them in the space in front of you, in those first few rows. And then we have the strangers, these countless beings that we don't really know that directly in this life. In the theater, they're in the dark of the theater, kind of filling up our show, but nonetheless, people that we're not aware of, beings that we don't have an awareness of at this time. If we're just visualizing them around us, and they're a vast ocean of beings going out in all directions, again, maybe hard to visualize strangers, but nonetheless, you know, these are beings that we have to take into account to make this immeasurable. And then the last group that we're having a more defined relationship with are the difficult people. We sometimes call these enemies. And they're the people who are sort of on the sidelines in the theater that are, you know, occasionally doing things that upset us, that annoy us, that even cause us to get irritated, hateful. And if you're visualizing beings surrounding you in just a general meditation, you can think about the enemies or difficult people in the space in front of you, kind of confronting you. So whichever visualization you choose, just try to think that you've got all three groups in the space around you. And I'd like you to select one being from each group. And it might be easiest to start with the person or being that you feel the closest to. Bring them forward to represent the group of friends. For the strangers, as I mentioned last night, it can be hard to identify an individual stranger to work with, but no doubt we have some beings in our lives that we've, you know, come into contact with, but we don't really know them. We've never really looked at them, smiled at them, interacted with them. People who work at the stores where you shop, people who even may work with you in another area of the business that you don't really know that well. And select one stranger, one sort of nameless person, being that you can bring forward and work with to represent that group. And then for the third group, the group of enemies or difficult people, you might not choose the one who is the most difficult for you, unless you feel kind of courageous today in working with them. But choose somebody who is in that category, who annoys you, who really causes you to have some difficulty in your mind, some level of annoyance, irritation, perhaps even hatred, anger. Once more, one person from that group to represent the people who are in that category. And now observe the person that you've chosen as a friend. And consider the particular bias that you might have for that person, that being. No doubt each of us has some level of attachment to that being. Attachment being that mind that sees them through the lens of the pleasurable things they've done for us, kind of sees them as being that in their entirety, wants to continue to have the attention, the care of that being, doesn't want to be separated from that being. And just acknowledging that that attachment is there, but just spend a moment looking at the friend that you've chosen and really understanding the particular bias that you have for them, the feelings that come up when you think of them, the attachment that you have for them. As you do this, also examine the reasons why you have that attachment. Where did that come from? What are the causes and conditions with relation to that person, that being, that have led you to have that attachment? And then turn your attention to the second person that you brought forward that represents the group of strangers. And notice what feelings arise. Notice what attitudes are there. When you look at that person, no doubt there's some level of indifference. And then begin to examine why that indifference is there. What are the reasons for having that attitude towards that stranger? What has caused you to have that indifference? Then finally, look at the third person that you've chosen to represent the group of difficult people. And notice what emotions come up here, what attitudes you have towards that being, that person. And here, no doubt each of us has some level of aversion towards that person. It might not be full-fledged hatred or animosity, but we have some level of irritation, annoyance, repulsion. And here too, observe why that's so. What are the reasons that you have that attitude towards that difficult person? Now, before we contemplate the reasons for having a more even-mindedness towards each of these individuals, reflect briefly on the disadvantages of continuing to have this bias, continuing to hold attachment for friends and indifference towards strangers, an aversion, hatred towards difficult people, enemies. See that these are the cause of your own suffering. They keep you from achieving your own greatest potential. And moreover, they do cause harm to others frequently. So now, with that strong desire to be free of those biases, we're going to begin by contemplating impermanence with regard to each of these. When we turn our attention back towards the friend, we can understand that while that person is a friend right now, we could question even whether they've been a friend this entire life. As was pointed out last night, many of the people who are our friends were strangers before. They came into our lives as strangers, and then we befriended them. Some of them might even have been enemies, difficult people for us initially, and we saw another side of that person, and now they are our friend. So as you look at this friend, begin to understand that there's a transitory nature to that label that we put on them. Considering them friend right now is nothing fixed. And when we consider prior lifetimes, no doubt that dear friend, that person that we've selected to work with as a close friend, was our worst enemy in one lifetime or another, has played a whole variety of roles in relationship to us. So just spend a moment reflecting on the impermanence, the transitory nature of these relationships with this one individual that you consider now to be your friend. And as you do this, begin to see if it loosens up some of the attachment that you feel for them. And now apply that same reasoning to the stranger, this person who we pulled forward to represent that group of people. Isn't it possible that at some point they might have a more direct contact with us? They could become a very close friend, or they could do something that causes them to be an enemy. So why do we have an indifference towards them? If there is that transitory nature to our relationship to that being. And once more, if we consider prior lifetimes, that stranger in this life has been very dear to you in another life, very kind to you, your best friend, has also played all the other roles. So why do we have this attitude of indifference, fixing them in that role of a stranger, when this is actually quite transitory? It's impermanent. Just spend a minute or so reflecting on the stranger in this way and see if it loosens up the sort of blind indifference that you have towards them. And then thirdly, turn your attention towards that person who represents the difficult people in your life. And recall the emotions that came up there. And those emotions were based on seeing them as being very fixed in that role, as a difficult person, as an enemy. But that role is transitory. It could change. We've seen this in our own lifetime, that some people who were difficult for us actually became very close to us. So this relationship could change in this life, but has changed from lifetime to lifetime. That person who is very difficult in your life right now has actually been very dear and close to you, has also been a complete stranger. So as you contemplate the impermanence of that relationship, see if it has an effect, a diminishment of whatever level of aversion, repulsion, anger, hatred that you have towards that being. And just to test your development of equanimity, kind of pull back and observe all three of these beings together, the friend, the stranger, the difficult person, and see if in some way you've eliminated some bias. It might not be at a level of perfect equanimity yet, but is there some even-mindedness that's there? Can you look at all three of these beings, and of course then the groups that they represent, with the same regard, with an equal regard, seeing them all as worthy objects of your love, your compassion. And then we'll try on the second reason for looking at beings with this equal regard, which is the fact that there's differing perspectives of each of them. So beginning with the friend, that person who represents that group, we know that they're a dear friend to us because that's the role that we see them in. But we can also understand that other people see them as complete strangers and have no regard for them. Other people might see them as difficult people, as even enemies, and might hate them. So as we look at that friend and have that understanding that other people see them in a very different light, who is correct? Should begin to once more undermine some of the attachment we have for that friend, that distortion. Because we see that actually they have many different aspects to them and are seen in differing ways by different people. So just spend a minute contemplating that in regard to the friend and once more see if it diminishes to some degree the attachment that you have for them. And then move your attention to the second person, the stranger, and do a similar exercise. There are people who love that stranger, who find them to be their dearest friend. There are people who find that stranger to be their worst enemy. And to you, there's the appearance of simply a stranger, someone you don't know, don't have contact with. Because of these differing perspectives, is there a valid basis for our indifference, our blind indifference towards that person, that being? Reflect in this way and see if you can diminish some of that lack of regard. And then go on to do a similar exercise with the third person, the difficult person. That difficult person is someone's dearest friend, also a complete stranger to many others. So once more, who is correct? Is there a valid basis for you to look at them through the lens of annoyance, anger, aversion, hatred? See if introducing this idea helps to diminish whatever level of aversion you have towards that being. And then try to, as before, take in all three of these beings and see to what degree have you cultivated some level of equal regard for every one of those three. And acknowledging if there's still bias there, that's okay. We're working on diminishing that. But just see if this meditation of seeing how there's differing perspectives of those three individuals, has that had a diminishment in the bias, in the partiality, the prejudices that you have towards each of those three beings? Do you have more of an equal regard for them? On this last part, we're going to do, for brevity, just in taking in all three of these individuals, and you can just work with them, you know, one at a time on your own, but try to see the ways that those three individuals, and therefore all the beings that are in the groups that they represent, are the same. First, in the fact that every one of these beings simply wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. There's no difference in that fundamental desire that every one of these beings has. And then secondly, the fact that every one of them has a mind that has both positive and negative qualities, just like your own. Although we tend to see just the positive qualities of the friends, the negative qualities of the enemies, and we're blind to the qualities of the strangers, each of those three individuals has both positive and negative. Their minds are very similar to our own. And lastly, we can also see them as the same in terms of their fundamental potential, whether it's our friend, the stranger, the difficult person. Every one of them has a mind that is fundamentally pure. Every one of them has the potential to remove all the impurities in the mind, all those negative tendencies, and to develop to a limitless degree the positive qualities. We all have the same potential. Every being in these three groups has the exact same potential. So contemplate this as well as the other two ideas. See how you can begin to develop some level of equanimity on the basis of all these beings being fundamentally the same in their desire for happiness and freedom from suffering, in their having minds that have both positive and negative qualities, and in this fundamental potential that each of them possesses to develop their minds fully. And here to check in with what level of equanimity you have for these three individuals and the groups that they represent. Whatever taste you have of that even-mindedness, just acknowledge that and see that this is something wholesome and good that you would like to have yourself in that complete form, but that you would also like all sentient beings to possess. As I mentioned last night, how wonderful the world would be if beings were free from these three distorting attitudes, free from all hatred, attachment, all blind indifference. If every being in every realm of existence, especially this world, were to have an equal concern and regard for all other beings, and so we'll cultivate that thought, making it stronger through the four-line verse that begins with the immeasurable aspiration. And if you'd like to recite that with me, you can. It's on that prayer sheet, the four immeasurables, the very first line. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So pause here and just really hold that thought. How amazing, how wonderful it would be. Just as you've begun to taste that equanimity, wouldn't it be wonderful if every being were to abide in that state? No longer any bias, any prejudice. And then to make this stronger, as if you were a ruler making a decree, we recite the next line. May they abide in equanimity. So here we kind of have that immeasurable prayer. May this come to pass. May this not just be a thought of how wonderful it would be, some sort of aspiration, but may this actually come to pass. May every being abide in equanimity. And hold that thought and feel it very deeply in your heart. And then with the third line, we take personal responsibility. As we discussed last night, you know, we cannot be the actual single cause for beings to have that state of mind. But nonetheless, we can take that on and do what we can to develop our own qualities all the way to Buddhahood, to be able to help others to cultivate this mind of equanimity. So let's say this third line with that kind of courage and commitment that each of us possesses to some degree to achieving this goal of helping all sentient beings in this way. I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity. And even if we're just saying this and don't really feel it in our hearts, it's perfectly fine. But if you do feel that in your heart, this strong desire to help beings to know that mind of equanimity, to live from that place of freedom from partiality, and muster that up and feel that very deeply. And then you can visualize in the space above you the Buddha of compassion, forearm Chenrezig, that simpler form. His first right hand and first left hand are holding a wish-fulfilling jewel at his heart. His second left hand is holding an open lotus, and his second right hand is holding a crystal rosary. He's seated in the Vajra position on a lotus and moon seat above you. And he embodies, you know, all four of these qualities that we're trying to cultivate. White in color with a peaceful smile. And even if you can't visualize, you can simply imagine that you have this energy that represents the culmination of all these qualities in the state of Buddhahood. And you're seeking the inspiration and blessings to be able to accomplish this, recognizing that we don't yet have these perfected. And as we recite this last line at the end, you can feel rays of light and nectar descending down, entering through the crown of your head and blessing your own mind so you can actually achieve this. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do so. And feel the blessings of Chenrezig, who is the same essence as your own guru. And then dedicate any positive potential from having done this meditation so that we can achieve that eventually, attaining the state of enlightenment, helping all sentient beings to know the taste of equanimity in the same way that we are trying to cultivate it. Okay. So let me see if there's any questions from the meditation. And then we're going to do a short break, because the 2.5 hour session is a bit long, but yes, wait for the microphone and then we'll... So yes, Anna.
Hi, Don. I'm having a problem here because I would think that it seems arrogant to say, I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't first we say, please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this? And then... So I understand that blessings, grant mm-hmm. me blessings, grant me to transform my mind. At what point and who is it, is the practice itself blessing our mind? I mean, if you could just explain what this blessing thing is. You know, I constantly see blessings, even with Tata, bless me, or wherever it is. So grant me blessings. We're asking someone to bless our mind, or is it our own practice?
Wow, it's a complicated question.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right.
And then, as I said, shouldn't that come first? And then I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity after I am blessed, after my mind is transformed. I mean, I'm just...
I guess you could look at it either way. I think the way that it's laid out is because we generate that aspiration, that thought, you know, that responsibility to say, I will do this for all beings, and then we seek the blessings of the Guru to be able to accomplish that. So our initial thought comes before it because we have to say, I want to do that, and then seek the aid and the inspiration of the holy beings to be able to do that. That's, you know, but I see what you're saying, that it would make sense in some ways to receive the blessings first, and then perhaps we can get
but
there.
Also, if you could just, so if we don't ask the blessings, how important is that? We will not be blessed. We will not transform our mind. Is that...
Well,
I'm not sure.
Right, I understand. And so when we start talking about kind of these holy beings and the role that they play in our lives, I think it's a big subject, and I'll try to talk about it a little bit. But essentially what we mean is that, and of course it's all part and parcel of what we're each about when we cultivate these sorts of thoughts. When we're sitting here and thinking, may I become a Buddha and do all of this for other beings? May I attain this state to be able to benefit others? Well, we're in a state now where we haven't attained that, and we're seeking the blessings and the aid of beings who've already accomplished that. Just as when we've accomplished that, others will be looking to us and trying to receive. So there has to be some confidence that there's some ability to have an interrelationship there. Faith is a part of it, and faith in Buddhism is never a sort of blind faith. It's a faith that's grounded in reason, that's grounded in our own experience and understanding of what the path is about. So kind of what we went through last night in talking about what is the role, because this was to Jack's question. Where's Jack right now? There's Jack. Jack's question of kind of like, how can we cause them to abide in equanimity? We cannot be the single only cause for doing that. But if we get to a state of Buddhahood where we are in that position of the being who's providing the blessings, the inspiration, the sort of, they call these, the literal translation is kind of waves of magnificence or something. The idea being that we can have a direct interactive capability with other beings, then what we're seeking by making these aspirations is that we will have that come to fruition, that we'll actually be in the position where we can benefit others to that degree by being able to be in their lives, connect with them in real form, and inspire them through the teachings that we are able to give them. Yeah, I think it's from our side we're reaching. The beings who've achieved that state, who are sort of out there, who are pervading everywhere, because we can say that the Buddha's minds, the omniscient minds of all enlightened beings, are pervading all of time and space. We're never without that kind of being there. That we have the potential to tap into that, to be able to benefit from that. His Holiness the Dalai Lama in one teaching actually said, going back to faith, that if we use the analogy of a radio antenna, of course now these analogies are all getting to be kind of a bit dated. People don't listen to radio so much, but, you know, I guess satellite radio, it's a similar thing, right? You've got waves, right? You need an antenna. You need something, a conductor, to be able to receive those waves, right? If they're all here. I mean, the FM waves are all going through us right now, without a doubt. If we had a radio antenna up, we could hear what's being broadcast. Well, the antenna that we need to have up in order to receive all of that is our antenna of faith. And faith in Buddhism, sometimes I do a whole little class on faith, because faith in Buddhism does have a different flavor than the way that we talk about faith in other spiritual traditions. At least I grew up Roman Catholic. It's very different from how faith was taught there, because faith is very much grounded in reason and in our own confidence and conviction that we develop in the teachings on the basis of an understanding, on the basis of our getting in there and working with them. So it's not something where we have a blind faith. So it's kind of a mutual process. You have the Buddhas at that state where they fully attain that, and they're just radiating out, just like the sun is radiating out light rays all the time. This radiation is always there. Will we receive it or not? It depends on the work that we do. So some beings are not capable of receiving the blessings of the Buddhas, the inspiration, the guidance of the Buddhas, simply because they haven't created the causes from their own side. So every time that we recite a verse like this or do a practice with a green tar or any of these holy beings that represent particular qualities that we want to cultivate ourselves, it's like we're opening up ourselves up to be able to receive their help and inspiration as, like, to do that in tandem. Because we're not doing it solely by ourselves, nor are we solely relying upon the Buddha, so that the Buddhas are going to do it for us. Rather, it's a mutual relationship. And so blessings and inspiration are really kind of that way in which we open ourselves up to being able to be under the influence and guidance of those beings.
You know, we're asking for their help.
Exactly. And that's what they're there for. And that's what they're there for. That's just like we want to be there for others in this way, the aspiration that we're making. You know, may we be the cause for them to be free from suffering and to have happiness and so on. All those beings made those same prayers as us, with those same aspirations, developed their mind to that degree so that they're in that position to best benefit us. Now, of course, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we often talk about the guru as being the medium through which all of that comes, because the guru is a physical form that we can relate to. The lamas and gurus are these beings who we see in that role of being the kind of conduit through which all of the energies of the Buddhas come and are received by us. And of course, at the more ultimate level, we see them as actually being enlightened beings, Buddhas who are manifesting in that form. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, in one teaching he gave on guru devotion, said that he used the analogy of a well, a very deep well, very dark and dank, and we're sort of in the bottom of the well. This is where we are, you know. We're in the darkness of samsara, of this conditioned existence. And the Buddhas are up on top in the light, in the wonderful fresh air of Buddhahood. Well, they need a way to get to us. And how they get to us is through the rope that is the guru. So they throw the rope down, you know, and it's up to us to hold on to the rope and work our way up, right? But we need the guru to hold on to. So there's an interrelationship there. There's the Buddhas, the enlightened beings, our own, you know, conditioned state, and the gurus being the way that the Buddhas are able to help us to be free from samsara. But the gurus, again, don't have the ability, just like the Buddhas don't have the ability to simply sweep us up out of the dark, dank well of samsara. Rather, we have to hold on to that. That's our faith and our conviction through our practice to continue to get up to the same state, the Buddhahood that the gurus are a manifestation of. Yeah.
They want to help, like, kind of.
Absolutely. And this is the thing, is like from our side, we need to create that. This is a very important part of our practice, and that's why a lot of these devotional practices, devotion, once more, is a loaded word when we come from other spiritual traditions. Devotion is about aligning ourselves with that energy. That energy is there, waiting for us to seek its assistance and aid, and we have to put ourselves in the best position to benefit from that.
Is that why joy is so important? Because when you're joyful, yeah, you're like, wow.
Yeah, we'll talk about that with joy tomorrow morning, yeah.
In Tada, joy at every stance is joy. That's another thing.
Yeah.
In the West, hey, we don't know what joy is.
I agree with you. There's a wonderful book that I teach on sometimes by His Holiness and Archbishop Desmond Tutu called The Book of Joy. You may have read it, but it's really about kind of all these various practices that help us to be more in a joyful state. I mean, the Buddhas are in a joyful state. Look at His Holiness and look at all these amazing beings, you know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. They're never, like, miserable. Yeah. I think so. I mean, we see that as, like, a really positive force. Having that joy in our hearts is transformative. It allows us to have some sort of fundamental energy behind everything that we're doing. That's why even joy is part of what we call joyous effort in the Mahayana path, that we want to be bringing this sort of exuberance to everything that we do. Everything goes so much easier when we have that. You know, if it's drudgery, yeah, then we're doing it wrong, I think. You know. Yeah, thanks for that question, Anna. Yeah, Andre.
Well, I hate to be a downer. I was talking about joy. But
you're going to be.
Yeah. Because it's a question that I get quite a bit. This question comes to my mind as well when I'm doing a meditation like this. Mm-hmm. And that is that, you know, it's like, you know, friend, enemy, stranger. It's like with the enemy, the difficult ones in our life, that becomes really, really personal.
Right.
Yeah, we could say, okay, yeah, maybe this guy is this person is not this way with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this person is good to other people, but it's not good to me. You know, and so
understand.
And we take it very personally. It's very hard for us to actually to really have some kind mm-hmm. of compassion and wishing them well and so forth. It's really hard. Because that's when it becomes really, really real, and that's when these practices become really, really real, and we've got to really look, well,
sure.
Should I forgive this person, for example? I get a lot about forgiveness, and people
mm-hmm.
say, well, why should I forgive him? You know, he's not good to me.
Mm-hmm.
He did this to me.
Mm-hmm.
He hurt me, you know?
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you could speak on that a little bit, mm-hmm. how to get to that place with and not take it so personally, because
right.
it's kind of hard not to.
No, absolutely. And I think that if we talk about this analogy that we're all working from, of like us being on the stage and this is our audience, and we do have people that are interrupting our show. They might not be interrupting anyone else's show, but they are definitely doing that to us. So it's very easy to take it personally. Why? Because we think it's our show. So we get down to these kind of deeper reasons that we haven't really touched on so much yet. We're going to get into them more when we talk about love and compassion, because that's when we're really challenged in terms of not just having an equal regard for those beings, but actually opening our hearts to them. What's it like to say we really care about the happiness and want the happiness of our enemies and want them to be free from suffering? That's where it becomes even more challenging. But the fundamental place where we are askew, where our ignorance is most operative, is in regard to this self that we are grasping at, and also the self that we then are cherishing and holding to be most important. It's most important how they act to us versus how they act to someone else. It's even playing out in that. You know, so any time that we have this distortion going on of self-centeredness and of self-grasping and holding tightly to this fictitious self that we think is here. Again, there is a self that exists, but this idea of a self that we've created that isn't here at all. Once we have that operative, then we're going to fall into those same types of patterns. And it's going to be, our bias is going to be to always see things through the lens of how others affect us. So the deeper work that we have to do, frequently in Buddhism we talk about the wisdom wing and the compassion wing, a bird needing two wings in order to fly. And this weekend we're mostly talking about the compassion wing. We're mostly talking about how do I create all of these sorts of wonderful qualities that are like the fuel in the tank that help you to get there. But you need to have the wisdom wing too. Because if you don't start addressing these distortions that are happening at the deeper level, the way that we're grasping at that self, and then, again, being quite primarily concerned about that sense of self, we're not going to be able to do this other work fully either. And we're not going to touch on that as much this weekend simply because we're mostly working with kind of the compassion wing or the method wing, as it's sometimes called, all those things that inform our heart. Whereas this is more of a head wing. This is more of how do we actually get in there and deconstruct this strong sense of self that we're adhering to. And maybe I'll touch on that if I have a little bit of time this weekend. So obviously what you're bringing up is rooted in the idea that we are going to still have that lens of whatever it is that we're experiencing affected by our self-centeredness, affected by our self-grasping. And we're going to continue to have a bias that sees things through the lens of how others affect us. And so it can be hard to overcome some of that bias without doing deeper work and deconstructing that self. But we can still, in my estimation, do something to bring it down to at least an equal regard. And then as we go into love and compassion, begin to test some of that, particularly that self-centeredness, that self-cherishing that is at the root of so much of our bias and so much of our keeping our hearts closed to others. Yeah. So something we'll explore. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. What's your name?
Regarding Adriana.
Adriana.
Yes. Regarding what you were saying, it's very easy to, when you have a difficult person or you've been in difficult situations, to feel, you know, justified to say, well, I didn't do anything, you know, to you, like, why do you behave this way, or why did you try to kill me, or hit me, or spit in my face, or, you know, countless things that other people can do. and feel entitled, you know, to retaliate or be upset, angry, feel, you know, injustice and all these things. To me, what, you know, after being, after coming to the center for, you know, a couple of years, maybe a year, and doing these practices, you know, like meditating and compassion and rejoicing, at some point, something shifted and I was able to look at the perpetrator, you know, if you want to call it, in a different way, like that person is suffering. Obviously, I am not doing anything purposefully to create, you know, anger or, you know, to create that negative response toward me. I am not doing that consciously right now. And obviously, whatever is going on with that person has nothing to do with me. You know, so that happened to me. And when I had that shift, you know, I was able to not be upset, not be angry, not be, you know, trying to retaliate or, you know, engage in like, oh, no, my way, your way, this or that, you know. So, because I was like, well, I was just sitting here and I was very happy. Like, why do I have to feel miserable now? Because you just, you know, had a rough day. You know, like I don't know, you just didn't wake up, you know, in a happy place. So I was like, no, I'm not. I was able to do that. But it was after, you know, I don't know what was it, really, but there was that shift. And in these days, regarding, you know, this whole equanimity thing, my perspective or my idea of friends and also enemies has also shifted. Like, I don't feel that much expectations from people that I consider friendly to me. You know, I do notice that I do things unconsciously to get certain response. You know, like, because I am craving certain response. But, you know, when I realized that, I was like, oh, maybe I'll do it, but with a different intention. Mm-hmm. You know, and with the enemies is the same. Like, I am able to do that separation. You know, they are suffering and all these things. The difficulty I'm having is with the so-called neutrals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For me.
No, I mean, it used to be like that before, but currently the strangers are no longer strangers to me. Mm-hmm. Because of the state, you know, that the political state, the mental state pervading everywhere, there is not like that. Before, you know, a couple of months ago, I was able to just go outside and just look at everyone and say, oh, kind sienten being, you know, kind sienten being, just be like floating. But, you know, I've been having a lot of problem. I don't see strangers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. It's, you know, particularly when you are on the receiving end, you know. It's easy when you're not receiving, you know, negative things, you know, from strangers. But when you're on the receiving end, then you're like, oh, okay, so I'm in regarding to strangers, and that's the challenge, you know, that I'm trying to explore in this during this weekend, is how to approach that, because I'm in a you know, defensive mode, like what's going on, what's going to happen when I go to the supermarket, you know, or to my children, or, you know, like I have to be in that state. I can't be, oh, you know, like I used to be, oh, yes, I'm just going to go to the supermarket and smile at everyone because, you know, they spit at you or something, you know. It's really, stuff is going on outside that the strangers are the difficult you know, people for me. And it helps the karma idea, you know, to understand a little bit, but in a practical way, because this is where we're functioning right now. I'm trying to find like a middle ground, you know, where I can, okay.
Right.
Okay, it's just like me, they're suffering. So
yeah.
it's very different. I come from a place where nobody feel or believe that we're better, you know, than our neighbors or stuff like that. It's not in our mind stream, so it's really hard for me to relate to that. I can't really, I haven't been able to come to terms to it.
Thank you for sharing that, Adrian. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll see if there's any other comments before we go on to Immeasurable Love, which was the main topic we wanted to spend some time with in this. So let's take just like 10 minutes, if that's possible. I usually say 10, and then it ends up being 15. But if I say 15, it'll end up being 20. So 10 minutes. All right. So let's see if there's any final questions on equanimity. Lee has a question.
Hi. Last night you were speaking about how equanimity is not kind of a bland neutrality.
Right.
And I was wondering, when one experiences genuine equanimity,
mm-hmm.
what is the emotional tenor of that? What does that feel like? Is that, would you say it's like a warm emotion or a feeling of affection for all beings?
It's a good question. I would say it's probably close to what you're describing, a sense of an affection or a concern. There's a wonderful little paragraph or two that I want to read from Kathleen McDonald's book that talks a bit about this, where it was a bit of what I was mentioning as well about how we're still acknowledging that people are going to have different roles that they play, but it also talks a little bit about what this equanimity is like. So let me read this. It's page 110 of her book, Awakening the Kind Heart, and the section's called Equal but Not Identical. Having equanimity does not mean that we will have the same relationship with everyone. This would be impossible. Even if we felt the wish to have a close friendship with each and every person, not everyone would feel that way toward us. There would be people who dislike us or even hate us. Also, cultivating equanimity does not mean denying that there are some people who are kind to us and others who are harmful. What it means is changing our attitudes, learning to stop differentiating between those we like and wish to help, those we dislike and do not want to help, and maybe even want to harm, and those we don't care about. Our mind heart is open to everyone equally. So this is the idea of again, that we're not redefining the groups that these beings are in, but we have an open-hearted quality to every one of them. And then the analogy that she uses to describe what that's like that gets to what your question is, Lee. A good analogy for the state of mind we're trying to develop is that of a doctor. Robbie can tell us about that, right? He or she treats all patients equally, whether they are wealthy or poor, attractive or unattractive, a criminal or a law-abiding citizen, male or female, young or old, of the same religion or political party or a different one. Similarly, a person with equanimity has an open heart to all beings, seeing all beings as equally deserving of one's love, compassion, and concern. So, does it help, you know, does that help you too, Luke, Lee? Because, I mean, what we're really talking about is just you would have that, you would look upon sentient beings with the same regard. So whether that's your dearest friend in the front row or the person who's the most annoying person in your life, you can still have an open heart towards them. You can still say, I will be equally concerned for your welfare. And, of course, the welfare comes in the next two immeasurables when we talk about placing beings in happiness and the causes of happiness and placing them in freedom from suffering and the causes of suffering. So, yeah, Lee, did you have something more?
Thank you. Is there kind of an emotional feeling in that, like a real affection or a real feeling of warmth, or it's more of just sort of a
way
of thinking?
I would say that there is a warmth. There should be a warmth. I mean, an attitude of equanimity should make one feel with that open-heartedness that we're in touch with that. We're going to talk about this when we get more into those that have a stronger emotion to them, like love and compassion, where we can actually feel maybe a bit more of an opening of the heart. Pema Chodron talks about how her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, used to call this the soft spot. And we all have kind of this soft spot that is armored to some degree. And we probably live our lives with a lot of armoring around it and don't frequently break all of that away. These meditations are to help us to be able to be in that soft spot continually and to be okay with that, even though that is a very vulnerable place to be as well, to have the courage and the strength to be coming from that place of this soft spot. So this is an analogy again, and a way of describing kind of what we're trying to work on, and this is a place of warmth. It does have some vulnerability, as I said, as well. So it can be a place, someone asked me during the break to talk about fear, Diane asked, and I think fear is definitely something that comes up when we have some vulnerability. And the relationships that we have with enemies and difficult people is one where fear frequently arises, because that's when we feel most vulnerable, when others are in that position of harming us or attacking us. So fear is definitely a possible emotion that we can have when we start opening up our hearts to some degree, or even just being in the presence of those who are potentially going to harm us. But fear is a whole topic. I mean, that I appreciate Diane's question, but I'll touch on it here and there. Maybe when we talk about compassion in particular, when we start talking about the vulnerability that comes, that is a part of having a real empathic concern for another, that we need to be in touch with in order to generate compassion more genuinely. But so I would say, back to your question, yes, it is. It should feel warm. It should feel like an openness, like we're kind of beginning to get in touch with that soft spot. Yeah, Denise.
I was just going to offer the word connection. You know, maybe it's about connection as an emotional tone.
Yeah.
See what you wanted to say about that.
Yeah. No, I think connection is another good word. Where we don't feel this sense that we're isolating ourselves from others, but that we're open to all beings. So in that way, we could say, yeah, it's a very connective feeling, like acknowledging that. Yeah. Yeah, Andre gets a microphone to you.
This is more of a thought or less than a question or anything like
okay.
that. But it seems to me that what we want to do with this practice and with these relationships, like with our friends, we want to be able to continue those relationships if it's possible, you know, to really and build on those relationships with our friends. Right. It seems like to me, like with the ones that we label as enemy, we want to do whatever we can, if it's possible, to change that relationship, to do what we can to make that person begin to not make, but help that person to begin to see us differently and begin to like us, maybe, or want to be around us and not be so troublesome for us. You know, I think about Robert Thurman and his book Infinite Life, and when we think about past lives and how we meet these people before and we will meet them again. And Robert Thurman said that if you want to have good parents, you want to have good good relatives, you know, you better treat everybody that you meet now with love and kindness, something like that, you know. And so I think about that. I really want to have good parents my next life, God. you know. So it's like, so, yeah. And I know that anyone here, anyone out there, anywhere, could be that stranger, that person I label enemy now, could be my father or my mother in my next life.
Yeah.
And so I do everything I can now to try to change that. Yeah. That dynamic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I think that there is a need to be attentive to all these relationships. That's why we're cultivating these four measurables, is so that they do start playing out in our kind heart being active in the world around us and our relationships with whoever we meet. Nonetheless, there will be relationships that we simply can't change, to what Kathleen McDonald was saying in that paragraph. There are going to be some people who the view that they have karmically that they've created of us is that we're awful people. And no matter what we do, no matter how kind we are, no matter how generous we are, no matter what we do, we're not going to be able to change that. So the goal isn't necessarily to change it, because once more, that change has to come from that person's side. But to do what we can to not validated anymore to try to create the causes from our side to not be harming that other person, you know, to not be doing anything that will cause that relationship to be the same in the future. But the way it's ripened now sometimes is impossible to overcome, you know. So yeah, this is part of the process, is acknowledging that we don't have control over everything either.
And then being okay with that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one way, and of course this is all revolving around karma, revolving around, again, karmically we've created those beings in our lives. And Pema Chodron, I quote her a lot because she's also a teacher that I've never had personal contact with, but I love her writings and her teachings. And she, I'm paraphrasing a bit of what she says, but she essentially says, karma is life giving you the lessons you need to learn. So we've created that difficult person. That difficult person's in our life for a reason. And if we, the main lesson we have to get is not create the causes to have that again, you know. And it's because fundamentally, just like all beings, we don't want to suffer. We don't want to be in those bad situations. But once more, to do that with a bigger attitude as well, that we would also want all beings to not be in those suffering situations, not be solely focused on me needing to get out of this what I can, but rather also recognizing that if I treat that difficult person harmfully and do things that just agitate them more and more, I'm only getting deeper and deeper bound up with them karmically and causing them to create the same patterns that will keep them in that stuck situation. That's why having the knowledge of karma and that as an operative principle is so important in our path. It plays into all of these things that we're talking about. It plays into almost every teaching. I think it was Venerable Dundrup, Neil Houston, who mentioned that in his, I think it's the video for Discovering Buddhism for Karma, that he feels that it's the most important teaching of the Buddha. And at some level you can say that that's very true, because cause and effect is the most operative principle that we have to tend to. If we want various effects in our lives, we want various results, and these are all about achieving the result of an open heart, a kind heart, and Buddhahood eventually, well then we have to create the causes for them. We have to be very attentive to that. So, good. Any other, yeah, Christine?
Yeah, you said something that made me think of something. I'm probably jumping the gun up a couple sections, but I'll forget if I don't ask now. You started yesterday with a quote from the Dalai Lama about compassion not being related to race or tribe, but it should be thought of as part of the human family. Well, I wanted to find that exact quote, where the source was. I couldn't find it, but I found it paraphrased in several articles, and a lot of them mentioned, and also on the Dalai Lama's website, about the difference, how important it is to know the difference between empathy and compassion. I found several different articles about, you just mentioned empathy. Are you going to touch on that at all?
Yes. Yeah, I'll touch on that when we get to compassion.
Okay, good.
Because I
think
it is
really interesting to me.
Because
I always think of being empathy as being good, and that was kind of like, you know.
Well, empathy is good.
It's good, but if taken.
But
was a warning there. Even the Dalai Lama was
warning. Well, and what I'm going to touch on is actually a teaching Denise attended, the FDCW course that I did out in California. That is a program that we're hoping will really take off at some point, the art of fulfillment. And in that course, we talk about balanced empathy. So what His Holiness is talking about, I think, is empathy where it's not so balanced, or where we actually could go astray because we're not staying in tune with what empathy really is about, kind of keeping it in that balanced domain. I'm going to touch on that a little bit if I've got time, but yeah.
I just want to touch on what Andre said. I just don't want to be reborn again, period.
Join the club. But yeah. At the same time, yeah. No, I appreciate that. And I think, again, that's really the mind that precedes bodhicitta. You know, when we talk about our spiritual path in terms of the three stages of the Lam Rim, or the three levels of capacity, you know, even at the second level, we're still quite focused on ourselves and developing that heartfelt mind we call renunciation, which is, I've had enough of it. You know, I renounce suffering and the causes of suffering, and we're going to be exploring suffering when we look at compassion. But the idea is that we have to get to that place where staying in samsara for another second is, as Rinpoche says, like the thought of, you know, using used toilet paper, or as Venerable Rabina said, you know, eating your own vomit. I mean, you know, something really repulsive. You have to get to that place where it's so repulsive that you would stay in samsara for one more second to get that mind really at that deep level. Of course, it doesn't stop there, because then we go on to say, but I will endure the sufferings of samsara for the sake of sentient beings, for the sake of others. So it's not complete when we get it just to renunciation. We have to go on to that additional thought that we're not alone in our suffering.
That's the Mahayana.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's perfect. We need to get there too. So, yeah, Fran.
If someone perceives, if your enemy, if mm-hmm. they perceive that you are doing something to them,
right,
and you're not, and you have no control over you, over it, do they ultimately, well, I guess when we cross over, whatever, do they ultimately realize that?
I don't know that I know the answer to that. I would say that, at some point in Buddhahood, they realize everything, so they would realize everything, but I don't know. I mean, I think that, again, we have a lot of biases that are there that are just karmically conditioned. I mean, I've had these interactions with people where it's like, I wasn't apparently doing anything in the moment, and they're like all of a sudden just accosting me and being really difficult to me. And it's like, where did that come from?
I mean, this is not mental. This is a physical issue.
Right.
It's a physical issue that, I mean, I didn't build my community, let's say.
Right, right.
So I don't know whether there's something wrong with her, or I don't think there is.
Right.
But I didn't build a stone wall. The community built a stone wall with drainage and things.
Uh-huh.
And she's blaming me and telling me it's my fault.
Right, right. So again, there's some karma there that you're being seen through the lens of being the difficult person, the enemy to her, regardless of what you've done. You know?
Oh, no, she's...
I mean, there's lots of things that I would suggest doing that, you know, might be useful to, like, really treat her, as Andre was saying, you know, with so much kindness
talked.
And do as much as you can to alleviate that. But
there's
nonetheless...
There's nothing I can do. This is not... Like I said, I didn't build the drainage system. So there's
so
nothing...
Then,
she's been told, but it's just not...
Right, right.
But
I understand.
She still blames me, and I don't... I mean, I have not... Yeah.
And this again
but she's
happens.
She's been told by legal people and.
Yeah. Again,
I guess
we have to acknowledge that there are some things that simply we can't do anything about. This is a level of what we might call our acceptance of
situations. I'm assuming that once we cross over, though, she's going to know
ridiculous. I don't know if that. necessarily comes with kind of, and by crossover, do you mean just like dying, leaving from this life? Well, then I don't think we gain any more knowledge from going from life to life. I mean, we gain our knowledge in that life, and we take it with us to the next life. I don't think we gain anything just by shedding this physical form and taking on a new one. You know, so I don't think that there's any sort of imparting of knowledge that happens in that process to answer that part of it. But if I go even further to like, well, will she ever have any realization about that? Well, who knows? I mean, the karma may change, and that's going to be something that you might not have a whole lot of effect or ability to affect.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. That's a tough one.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Fran. I hope someday she does. I mean, but at the same time, you know, you accept it. There's a wonderful verse by Master Shantideva where he essentially says, if it's something that you can do something about, why get all worried and bent out of shape? Because you can do something about it. If it's something you can't do anything about, well, why get all worried and bent out of shape? Because you can't do anything about it. You know, so we see that our own sort of worry.
The thing is that I do care about
it. Oh, sure, sure, and that's good.
No.
Yeah. And this is where, once more, sometimes the best work that we can do is simply to use that on the cushion to continue to work with it in our own hearts with this equanimity meditation to try to generate as much, you know, of a concern for her and all the others who are manifesting in a similar way, who are difficult in our lives, and just to try to have that, and then on the basis of that, generate love, compassion, and then see what happens, you know. Sometimes things do change, you know. Yeah. Let's go on to immeasurable love, because otherwise we'll only have like two or three immeasurables over the weekend. You only get two or three paths to awaken a kind heart. So, by the way, there was a question that Peter asked about the source of all of this in the sutra. And in the Theravadin tradition, there actually is something that's called the Brahma Abode Sutta, the Brahma Vihara Sutta, which is in the collection of progressive divisions. It's in the Pali canon that there are actually a full explanation of these. But the only one that I understand that really gets its kind of full explanation is love, immeasurable love, which is in the Metta Sutta, which is an exposition of loving kindness that is relied upon heavily in the Theravadin tradition. Let's go on to talk about love. This is obviously, when we use the word love and call this immeasurable love, we need to distinguish it right away from the way that we talk about love in our culture. Love here is that genuine wish for the well-being of another in terms of wanting them to have happiness and wanting them to be, you know, together with the causes of happiness, everything that would help them to have happiness. We're going to talk a bit about what that means in terms of what level of happiness we're really referring to. But it's very different from what we call love in terms of like a romantic love, or even the love that we frequently have, as we talked about last night, in regard to our families, the people that we are quite attached to and have that relationship with. What we're talking about here with love is this just kind of genuine, heartfelt wish for that well-being of another. That is, begins with ourselves and having love for ourselves, but also has love for all beings on the basis of the meditation that we've done already on equanimity. So let's read through on that second page. Let me get my copy of the handout too so I can refer to that. On that second page where it talks about immeasurable love, there's a quote from Kathleen McDonald. Let me read that. The desire for happiness unites all beings, human and non-human. Feeling love for others means acknowledging this desire, respecting it, and doing what we can to fulfill it. This kind of love is sometimes called loving kindness, to distinguish it from love that is mixed with lust or selfish attachment. Loving kindness is pure, unselfish, and unconditional. Immeasurable love means wishing all beings to have happiness and its causes. So we all have love to some degree already, or what we would call loving kindness. It's undeniable that we have that, or we wouldn't have any relationships with beings that are in our front row. We wouldn't have that ability to open our hearts to them with some concern for their welfare. So this is a given that we all have some degree of this. What we're trying to do in cultivating the immeasurable loving kindness is, as it said there, to be able to extend that to all beings, to be able to have that thought in regard to all beings, which people kind of can be a bit mind-blowing, right? How could I possibly have a heart that big? How could I possibly be open to loving every single sentient being? Even, again, those difficult people, which are the most challenging frequently, but nonetheless, we're going to look at kind of the techniques for cultivating that. Before I do that, though, I do want to touch on the benefits of loving kindness very briefly. This is a standard topic that is normally talked about when love is discussed in the Lam Rim, in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, for example, one of the books that I'm sure most of you have had some contact with. That's a discourse on the stages of the path to enlightenment. And I'm not going to go into them in a lot of detail, but most of the benefits of love we can see come from the fact that once we cultivate this mind or begin to operate from that mind, karmically, we're creating positive results. And this is once more why karma is such an integral part of our practice, because everything that we do with our hearts, with our minds, has its own results. So if we're going to, you know, have hatred and animosity towards others, that has its karmic result of others that will be out to harm you and to think poorly of you. If you create loving kindness and compassion towards others, well, then you're going to have the opposite effect. You're going to have beings who want to protect you, who actually have love and concern for you. So some of the benefits, for example, are that gods, humans, even non-humans will come to love and protect you. You will be happy mentally and have much physical pleasure as well. So we see that there's kind of both physical and mental dimensions to the happiness that we experience by developing loving kindness. They say that various instruments of destruction, poison, weapons, and so on cannot harm you. Of course, this doesn't mean that you develop kind of like an iron shield around you, a force field or something, that these things can't penetrate. It means that karmically, once more, you've created no causes for others to harm you because your mind is always one of wanting to benefit, wanting them to be happy. So again, this isn't an immediate thing. Oh, I did one meditation on loving kindness and then somebody, you know, stuck me with a knife later in the day. You know, that doesn't work. Well, these are like long-term effects of continuing to cultivate this mind. Once more, go back to the Buddha. I mean, the Buddha had Devadatta trying to, you know, send charging elephants at him and what have you. Yeah, his cousin, exactly. So even though he had that in his life, through the power of his loving kindness, it said that he was able to actually dispel those forces, like the scene that many of you know of when he was sitting in meditation, achieving enlightenment, and the Maras, these evil forces, kind of sent arrows at him, and he transformed them all into flowers. You know, we will see that at high levels of development, yes, you can do these sorts of things. But mostly what we're talking about for us is that karmically, we stop creating the causes for others to harm us when we generate love towards them. It kind of makes sense, right? I mean, we don't have to study a whole lot to get this. We just have to engage in the practices by which those results will be attained. It's also said that you will attain your goals without much effort, that, you know, all the accomplishments will follow from that. Love is said to be one of the most powerful forces in our world, and it can be a great boon to our practice in so many ways. And then, of course, the benefit that is set out in the Brahma Vihara Sutra that I was just referring to is that you will be reborn into the Brahma abodes. And that's why these are taught as kind of the Brahma Viharas, the Brahma abodes. What they mean by that is that there are actually these realms of existence that are part of the form realm, where they call them the Brahma abodes, where you can actually be reborn there through the force of your concentration and your development of these four immeasurable thoughts. That's not the goal that we're attaining by virtue of that, or that we want to attain, because we want to keep directing these into bodhicitta. That's why the last topic I'm going to talk about is how these four immeasurables fit into our development of bodhicitta. So it's not like we want to achieve these great, more blissful states of existence. They say that these form realm gods don't have any of the gross suffering that we have. You know, instead, they live in very pleasurable states, but it's only temporary. They fall from that state once the karma to be reborn there is exhausted. So it's not a final result that we're aiming for, is to be reborn in these Brahma abodes, but nonetheless, it can have that benefit. And of course, the final Brahma abode, if you will, is highest state of enlightenment. You know, this kind of what transcends all of this is the ability that we have to become fully enlightened through the force of our love, through the force of our compassion, and so on. Just so you know, similar benefits we could say are there for compassion as well, but they are generally set out in regard to love, because love, again, is a very powerful force, as we see. Nonetheless, compassion does have its kind of equal power, if not greater power at times. So let me talk a little bit more. Kathleen McDonald goes into other benefits from cultivating love, but I don't know that I need to spend so much time talking about those. It's better that we spend some time actually getting into understanding what this mind is and practicing it. And once more, having an intellectual understanding isn't the goal. You know, it's not like we can, you know, answer the test and say exactly what loving kindness is. It's better to feel it in your heart. So that's why we're going to spend more time actually cultivating it. It is important to talk about what we mean by true happiness, though. Because when we're sitting there and holding a thought for even just one person, or even ourselves, to have happiness and the causes of happiness, it's important to discern what we really mean by that. You know, are we talking about us having all measures of happiness, everything that we include in that category of happiness? Or, and also, what are the real causes of what we're actually defining as true happiness? So why this can come up is, for example, we do know that there is this unfortunate thing in our world in German. It's called Schadenfreude, which is taking delight or having happiness at the misfortune of others. You know, I remember even after 9/11, they had these photographs of bin Laden and gang sitting around some table somewhere watching what was unfolding on 9/11 and them being very happy and joyful that their plan had come to that fruition, you know. So we're not talking about that measure of happiness at all, right? We don't want others to have the happiness that takes delight in someone else's misery. That's a given to some degree, but I think it's important to touch on so that when we wish for others to be happy, it's not like we wish for someone who is president at the moment to have everything go their way necessarily, because if that causes suffering to others, then we don't want them to have that happiness that would ensue from them having their political promises come to fruition or whatever. You see what I'm saying? Again, I'm not... Those of you might be Trump supporters in the room, and if you are, that's fine, you know, but just know that that could hold for Obama as well. It could hold for anybody who is a presidential candidate who is doing things that you think are harmful to others. So, yeah, Christy.
I've been disturbed by seeing those kind of things on social media.
Yeah, yeah.
And the worst part is they call it karma, like go karma.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh, really?
So Christine's point was, yeah, that we do see this a lot in social media and people kind of even attributing it to their karmic consequences and being glad that somebody's kind of facing that. I mean, this is one of the worst misunderstandings we can have of karma, of kind of thinking that it's everybody kind of getting their due and us being kind of glad about it. It should be producing the exact opposite result, that we should be generating more love and compassion for beings because we see that they are through the force of their own ignorance of karma as well as the deeper ignorance that they're operating from, creating the causes of their own suffering, of their own misfortune, of them being unable to attain happiness. So every time that, you know, we see somebody suffering, don't take delight in it, no matter who it is. Rather see it as a potential opening for us to start looking at them through the lens of compassion or loving kindness. So love is certainly not wishing for the happiness that takes delight in the suffering of others. It's also, to some degree, not ultimately wanting the happiness that is just temporal. Nonetheless, we do see that temporal happiness, having enough food on the plate, having a, you know, roof over your head, having a car to be able to drive where you want to go, having all these things that we call sort of our temporal comforts, that we, it's not that we don't want them to be there for people, because we do understand that people are better capable of opening up to a spiritual path and being kinder to others when they do have those things in their lives. Not to say that that's an absolute, because many people, and myself can testify to this with the travels I've done to Nepal, that in many of the countries where they don't have all the physical luxuries that we have in this country, people seem to be happier there without all those things, whereas in this country, even with all those things, people are generally not that happy. So be careful what we wish for when we're wishing for people to have these temporal happinesses, because they're not the answer to everything, you know. Nonetheless, like I said, some measure of physical comfort and having those things in our lives is an important thing to acknowledge, that's a part of that happiness. But if we stop there, as I said, that's not good enough, because those are not the causes of real happiness. Everything that we have in that category, as we're going to see when we look at suffering as well, is unsatisfactory. It's not capable of fully satisfying beings. It doesn't have the potential to sustain that, and it doesn't completely remove that wish for happiness. That wish for happiness is still going to be there after all these temporal pleasures. Even after the most delicious, wonderful meal, it's not like it's with you all the time. It's not like you're able to continue to experience that pleasure. It's gone, and then you have to go after it again in order to recreate it. So when we are making this wish for the happiness of others, we can say to some degree we want them to have temporal well-being, simply because it is a good thing to have, to be able to use as a platform for further development of our hearts and our minds. But it is not the final solution. Instead, what we want is what we would call ultimate happiness. which is the happiness that is there when we are able to attain these more ultimate states, what we call liberation and enlightenment. And I want to distinguish what those two terms are just so that everyone's clear, because sometimes we use enlightenment just as a category for everything. In this tradition, when we say liberation, we are really talking about an individual's freedom from what is blocking them from some measure of peace and happiness. You know, so this is what's blocking us essentially from what we call nirvana. When an individual attains nirvana, they abide in a state of a pacified mind, a mind that's no longer disturbed, and therefore is experiencing that kind of peace that is something that we've never known in our lives. We have little maybe glimpses of it here and there. Sometimes in nature, we even have kind of an ability to be in nature and feel this overwhelming sense of just an inner joy or an inner well-being that's not conditioned in any way. But what we're talking about with nirvana is something that we've never really tasted, that that's only a small reflection of. So when we are wishing for others to be happy, it starts with wanting that more ultimate level of happiness that we could call liberation, a freedom from all the disturbing states of mind, a peace that one can abide in that is eternal, that will continue on forever, that's not conditioned in that way. The deeper level of happiness that we're wishing for all beings, of course, is enlightenment. And this is the state that is taught and practiced within the Mahayana tradition that we're all about here at, you know, Kadampa Center and all these other FPMT centers and all the other Mahayana traditions, Zen Buddhism, Korean Buddhism, Thich Nhat Hanh, his tradition of Vietnamese Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, Chan Buddhism, all of those are driving towards this greater state of well-being that we call enlightenment, which is when we have not only done the work of removing our own disturbing stuff, but we have gone on to remove the subtler obscurations in our mind that are what are keeping us from having the full potential of our minds realized. So what that's like, I mean, who knows? They always talk about it as the most blissful, joyful state of Buddhahood. Hard to say. Again, we have little ways that we maybe get a taste for what that's like in our lives, but we can't really know what that full experience is like because it too isn't really conditioned in the way that our experiences of happiness are, because it's lasting forever and continuing and is just an embodiment of that is the product of all the work that's done on the path. So when we're making this genuine wish for the happiness of others, we can start with temporal happiness. We can certainly want them to attain liberation, but we mostly want them to attain this unparalleled bliss of Buddhahood, this full enlightenment, because that's the state in which they will have fully developed themselves. That is what we all have the potential for, talking about Buddha nature last night. This is what we all can achieve. So it's important to have that as a distinguishing understanding. Let me just take a look at Kathy McDonald's book and see if she had anything more that's worth... I think this part is worth saying as well. This is on page 25 of her book. She says, it is also important to accept that not only does everyone want to be happy, which is the platform upon which we're working with this idea of loving kindness, but everyone deserves to be happy. It is our right as beings. We should be happy. We sometimes feel that we do not deserve happiness because we hurt someone or because a loved one is suffering. We think, how can I be happy when my friend is suffering? This is guilt, an unhealthy and deluded mental state. We need to recognize it and learn to avoid it. You know? So this is the important thing, is to recognize that not only do all beings have the potential for that deepest level of happiness, but they all deserve it. Even you deserve this. Every one of us. I know in the West we have struggled a lot with self-esteem issues and kind of putting ourselves down and thinking somehow we're not worthy or deserving of these ideal, lofty goals. But every one of you is. That's the starting point for all of these teachings, again, is to understand that fundamentally we're the same in wanting that happiness and desiring not to suffer. And we all deserve that result. That is what we're aiming for. As I said last night and even a bit this morning, you know, the problem is we're going about it the wrong way. And what we're learning this weekend is the right way. How do we actually achieve happiness? How do we actually be free from suffering? By cultivating these states of mind, these positive states. Okay, I think that's good enough. So there are many obstacles to loving kindness, and we'll encounter these certainly as we go through. You know, I skirted over Joan's. Joan isn't here today, is she? She brought up some issues last night. Maybe if she returns at some point, we'll invite her to talk a bit more. Obviously, we're going to see obstacles come up in regard to all of these, and sometimes quite specific with certain relationships, like the one you were talking about, Fran, where it might be very hard because in reality, you can't get that to change, so you have to change your own mind. We have to work with just kind of what we have to work with and to change. But we do see that there are many obstacles to these various mind states that we're trying to develop in the four immeasurables. With equanimity, we talked about, you know, of course, attachment and hatred, and then the sort of prejudice or bias that we have, those being the far enemies. With love, of course, the far enemy is this idea of kind of ill will, ill will or harmful intent, which is sort of another variation on our hatred or our animosity towards others. This is like the most opposing mind that can sometimes arise. It's not going to arise that frequently with the friends, and hopefully not. And with the strangers, maybe not as much, but it's going to definitely arise when we start working with generating loving kindness for enemies, for difficult people. Because our way of looking at them is through the lens of wanting to retaliate, not wanting to embrace them with loving kindness, but rather to do what we can to harm them because they've harmed us. We also see, though, that we can have some problems with, you know, our own selfishness. You know, this is what I mentioned earlier, that's at a deeper level behind our inability to practice these mental states of equanimity, love, compassion, and so on, is a tendency that we have to be very selfish, to be very much about me, myself, and I, and what I need. And this is why we're frequently challenged in terms of extending that loving kindness to others, is because we want things for ourselves first. Nonetheless, as I said earlier, even in the West, we have a lot of self-esteem issues that cause us not to even think that we're worthy of receiving what we, you know, desire, our own happiness and so on. So we get a lot of confusion that goes on that can become an obstacle to love. So you may see once more, just as we saw with equanimity, some of these states of mind arising that you might need to do deeper work on. So if you see a lot of animosity, a lot of hatred, ill will coming up with regard to enemies, well, then maybe you need to do some other meditations besides cultivating love that help you to diminish that anger or hatred before you can really generate love for that being. And again, there are many techniques to work with that, to think about the karma of the situation, to think about the disadvantages of anger, to think about the fact that the person who is harming you is under the control of their own delusions. I mentioned some of these last night. So it is important that whenever we have something that we're trying to work on that's a positive emotion, if we see that the negative ones that it's counteracting are quite strong, that maybe we have to go over her and tend to that first. And we're not going to be able to do all that work this weekend, but I'm just pointing that out with regard to each of these, because there will be some things that you might need to address based on your particular relationship with that person. Okay? Let me talk about the near enemy of loving kindness, because I think it is one that speaks to the fact that in our relationships with those that we love quite easily, what messes them up is attachment, is this kind of self-affection even, this idea that we want, you know, that person to continue to do what benefits us, right? This is something that, once more, we want to make sure that we keep out of the equation. And sometimes when we start feeling loving kindness towards another, especially those people in our front row of our theater, you know, that we already have a very good relationship with, it starts taking on the guise of attachment. It starts becoming about what I need for my welfare as opposed to what they need for theirs. So this is a near enemy. I mean, if we clearly can delineate these and know when attachment is there and self-concern versus when loving kindness is there, then it's not going to become a problem. Just like in equanimity, if we know when we have the true mind of equanimity, that Lee was asking, you know, what does that look like? What does that feel like? What is the emotive content of that? That's very different from indifference. That's very different from this kind of apathy towards others. So it's the same with loving kindness, and that's why we talk about these near enemies, is to make sure that we're not falling into a trap that we frequently do. Because I would say, again, without some exposure to these teachings in Buddhism, it's very rare that people delineate when there's love and when there's attachment in their relationships with those who are close to them. Is that what people have found generally too? Good. So it's important for us to have that understanding. Attachment, once more, is the mind that is very much about me, myself, and I, what I need for my well-being, and you continuing to do that for me. It becomes very conditional. Whereas love is about your welfare and your happiness and your well-being. And how can I be someone who facilitates that? Someone who helps you to have that? So you're only in the equation as someone who is concerned about the other person's happiness and well-being and helping them to have that. You're not in the equation in terms of what you get out of it. But nonetheless, as His Holiness points out, and this is true for both loving-kindness and compassion, which are kind of two sides of the same coin, this is how we're actually wisely selfish. How do you best meet your needs? How do you best fulfill that desire for your own happiness and well-being? By being concerned about the happiness and well-being of others. It's hard for us to get there. I'm not, you know, somebody who's advertising that this is an easy path by any means. But when we are in that space of being genuinely concerned about others, if that is what our goal is, self-fulfillment doesn't even come into it because we're not concerned about our own needs from that perspective of attachment, then our needs are being met. Absolutely. We are, because we are focused on the needs of others and their well-being and their happiness and their causes of happiness, without a doubt, our causes of happiness will be met. In the moment, we will be satisfied because we're doing what we're intending to do. And karmically, we're creating the causes for all of our well-being because we're practicing loving kindness and compassion towards others. His Holiness calls us being wisely selfish. If we admit that our deepest desire is to be happy and to be free from suffering, then we have to understand the best way to accomplish that. And it's by being concerned about others. And that's why we're going to work throughout this weekend and throughout all these different immeasurables with overcoming that selfish tendency that is focused on ourselves alone, what we frequently call self-cherishing or self-centeredness, and replacing it with a regard for others, with cherishing others. Is such an important part of the Mahayana path, but it's a part of all of these practices of loving kindness and compassion. So we're at about 12:30. Let me see if there's maybe just one or two quick questions and then we'll break for lunch. Yeah, Renee.
Well, I've always been curious about this thing that Western people tend to have more of issues with self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And culturally, why is that? What causes
yeah.
that?
You know, I think that the answers that I've heard to that question, I'm thinking here in particular, I think Alex Berzin in one of his teachings talks about how he attributes a lot of it to some of the spiritual traditions that we have bought into earlier in life have tended to think of ourselves in a more negative light. And again, I'm not trying to cast any stones at any of those traditions. I honor and respect all spiritual traditions, but nonetheless, the premise for many of the teachings in Christianity, for example, are that we're fundamentally flawed, that there's something fundamentally wrong with us, that in that way we're sort of not deserving of the things that we seek or the happiness that we want. And so we start off with a bit of a flawed view of who we are ourselves. That this idea of original sin, which many of you have heard in the room, I'm sure if you grew up, I grew up Catholic, and this was pounded into me from the very beginning that I was kind of flawed from the very beginning. I have this thing that I can never escape that defines who I am, kind of my being, my soul. Well, you know, that's kind of a hard thing to break away from then, to think that somehow we have this ability to transcend all of that, you know. And I know that Christianity doesn't teach that that's kind of the bottom line and we're never going to experience any level of happiness or well-being because they say that there is heaven and these states where we can actually accomplish that. But nonetheless, that's what flavors our view of ourselves to some degree. I think that we're also, you know, in the West, there's just in general a sort of unworthiness that kind of comes with the culture or something. I don't know if it has to do with competitiveness, judgment. A lot of these things that we do much more readily than I think in Eastern traditions, where we tend to put ourselves down, put others down, where there's a lot of critical thinking in this Western world. I don't know. I mean, maybe others have ideas about where this all comes from, but I do know that, yeah, this is something that was pointed out very early on to the Dalai Lama when he met with Western teachers way back in the 80s. They were asking him questions. I think it was Sharon Salzberg who asked, you know, Your Holiness, I have many students who have such low self-esteem. You know, how to get them to work with this and to really be able to have a healthy regard for themselves. And His Holiness was like flabbergasted. He's like, what are you talking about? People cherish themselves. They don't hate themselves. But in the West, I mean, we have self-hatred. We have self-loathing to that degree.
Just a comment.
Yeah.
I saw like a little TED talk or something recently that the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion, and that self-esteem implies a judgment. I'm better, you know, like that kind of thing, versus, you know, we're all kind of shades of gray, so to speak. It's not black or white, you know, better or worse, but the just loving yourself where you're at kind of thing, and seems the self-compassion more healthy.
And I think that this is the problem with when we address self-esteem issues in our culture, is that sometimes it borders into pride then, and into these kind of deluded states of mind of self-importance. When we build up our self-esteem, it almost becomes distorted in its own way. Everything in Buddhism, of course, is rooted in our fundamental faults of how we are thinking, our thought processes that need to be addressed. So whether culturally we have these types of issues in the West versus what's in the East, it doesn't mean that in the East they're somehow magically free of all the other delusions. It just means that these are different manifestations of the same sorts of patterns. His Holiness, when he looked further at self-esteem issues, he said that actually it is still self-cherishing. It's just an inverted form of self-cherishing, where we look at ourselves as the center of the universe, but we have a negative view of ourselves and kind of put ourselves down. And if we got rid of that self-cherishing, it would be a release to a lot of that, because we wouldn't have that focus on ourselves to begin with, and therefore we wouldn't have this lower view of ourselves. So it's kind of, they're all still rooted in similar ideas. It's just manifesting in different ways in different cultures. So let's take our break if we can. Aaron, did you have a quick... Hold on to your question now, please. And what we're going to do is we're going to take our break till about 2 o'clock. And when we come back, we're going to do the meditation on loving kindness. I know it's kind of hard after lunch to do a meditation, but it's important that we do at least one meditation on each of these so you get a flavor of the instruction. I haven't even gone through the instruction. So you'll get the instruction as part of going through the meditation. I think that'll be fine. And then we'll have a little more discussion on loving kindness. So save your questions for then. And then we'll go on to immeasurable compassion. All right? Okay, so let's have just a few thoughts of dedication. There may be some of us who aren't coming back for this afternoon. Hopefully that's by your choice. Let's hope that none of us have that impermanence that rears its head during the lunch break. But nonetheless, we want to make some positive thoughts on the basis of the last 2.5 hours that we've spent together. All the seeds that we planted through our own thinking, through the words that we've heard or said, may this all become the cause for us to open our hearts fully, to develop bodhicitta, to accomplish the path to enlightenment, and then to be able to lead others to that same state. Okay, have a good lunch break, and see you back here at 2:00.